From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guests have taken the world of TV by storm over the past few years or so, going back to, of course, Gilmore Girls and one of my favorites, Bunhead. And Bunheads, forgive me for not properly pluralizing it.
There are many heads.
Their newest success on Amazon is The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, its third season. I'm talking, of course, to Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino. Guys, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, you're
very,
welcome.
Very welcome.
And here's the thing I want to start off with, which I'm sure you get all the time, but your characters are so much about taste and their taste about things and asserting their tastes. I mean, going back to Gilmore Girls. And I mean, I even think about it in the pilot episode where Susie is giving the speech to Midge and saying that she believes in her and she sees in her something that nobody else sees. And it's really a reflection of her taste and sort of making that stamp and putting it out there for Midge to see. I guess I wonder where that comes from for you guys.
Well, we're very opinionated and...
No, we're not.
The more specific a character is, the more I think people can get behind the character. And, you know, pilots are a very tricky thing because in a pilot, you have to make the audience invest in a character they don't know, invest in a backstory that they are just being fed pieces of, and then sign on for the ride. It's a tricky dance. And so to lay out your case, so to speak, I think that for us, it's always been A, fun, and also to help sort of really define where the character is coming from, to sort of put very specific tastes out there, whether it be like mentioning the kind of books that they read, which will say, you know, whether they are a book reader or not, or the kind of music that they listen to, or the kind of movies or, you know, information that they want to talk about. It can say a lot about who the character is, you know, in a short amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, weirdly, like in TV over the many, many decades, you very, very rarely see people watching TV on TV. It's something that we writers forget is like consuming media like TV, movies, books and magazines and stuff like that is what people do a lot every day. And yet so many movies and television shows don't show people actually doing these things. So one thing on Gilmore Girls, we always had the girls watching a lot of TV and commenting on the TV, which is what I think people do, especially since March of 2020. So yeah, so we have people consume things and debate them and sometimes proselytize them. It's sort of what we all do every day kind of naturally. It's the fun of everyday life.
Also, you know, in something specific like Maisel is about discovering possibilities within yourself that you may not have known was even there. So it's important to have somebody else that sees it sometimes. You know, sometimes we walk around in the world thinking we're not special or we don't stand out. And sometimes it takes somebody to go, hey, you're the person that did that thing. And you're like, oh, wow, someone noticed. And that is what Susie and Midge are for each other. They are two women who in any other circumstance would have nothing to do with each other, wouldn't go near each other. Like they wouldn't want to stand, you know, in a checkout line at a grocery store with each other. But they have this mutual goal and they literally can't do it without each other. And the discovery of that, the discovery of they see in each other the cheerleader, the partner, the prodder, the person who sees what's special about them, it's kind of the core of the whole show.
No, I mean, that's an interesting thing, too. But I'm just thinking back to, you know, Lorelai's relationship with her mother from Gilmore Girls and how basically she saw the assertion of her mother's taste as a kind of fascism. And she broke from that and kind of made her taste a lot more, I don't want to say egalitarian, but a lot more open to the world. And I just think taste as a reflection of character in this specific way is really unique to the way you guys work. and it becomes a way to define character. It almost takes us back to the days of classic screwball comedy, where it was high and low, and high wasn't necessarily better. And just talking about taste and going back to the pilot, the way that Midge basically introduces herself to her own wedding toast, which already shows that she's different from anybody else in 1959, that she's toasting herself rather than waiting to be toasted.
Yeah.
But also that she basically goes through a very long route to outrage all the orthodox people at the wedding.
Yeah.
And again, for me, it's so much about taste, and that becomes a really interesting way to animate character rather than having them explain themselves in the more obvious ways we see in TV.
The problem you run into in storytelling is exposition, because people need to know a certain amount of exposition to be able to keep up with the story. But there's nothing more boring than somebody saying, hey, here's a page of exposition that I'm just going to tell you because you need to know it. And one of the hardest jobs as a writer is to hide the exposition. And one of the ways that we have found that really does get things across quicker is you get insights into people by things that they do, by actions that they take, by the way they react to someone opening a door for them, and you can make judgments about somebody without somebody giving you an expositional speech on their backstory if you can dramatize it like that. Anything that can be dramatized as opposed to told to you is infinitely a better thing. We have found, especially with our characters who are weirdly so chatty, you know, on all of our shows are super chatty and our people like to talk, but we like to have people talking about things that often are not what the scene is about. And the very fact that they're talking about this other thing while something else is going on, we find that interesting. And we think that it helps sort of actually even define how our characters maneuver in the world and how they work with other people, because they aren't talking about the thing that they are doing at the moment. They are just doing it, and then they're doing something else.
No, I think that's interesting, though, because what it becomes is a way, first of all, we're talking about is sort of classic acting exercises where you give a character something to play but not have them talk about it. So they're actually using that dialogue to express something that's really subtextual, which is also something we're not used to seeing on TV. But I think, too, the characters you guys write really are finally moved by their passions. And that's what creates so much tension and abrasion, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's, you know, on Gilmore, Lorelai clearly was somebody who needed a free-thinking environment to be able to flourish. And weirdly, the circle in Gilmore is because she has this great daughter, but the daughter, as much as she's like Lorelai, is also very much different than Lorelai. She's much more in her head. She's much more comfortable with structure.
Yeah,
she's
and
much
discipline.
And discipline, mm-hmm. and much more mm-hmm. willing to, you know, bend a little bit if it'll make someone happy, even though it's not necessarily what you want to do. But, you know, so what for an hour you put on a ball gown and you get paraded around a ballroom because it makes your grandmother happy. You know, whereas Lorelai is a little bit more like me, which is like, I don't want to do that. You're not going to make me do anything that I don't want to do because that's not my belief system. So you can keep your ball gown and shut up your ass, basically and that was sort of the interplay of Gilmore Girls that works so great is that the connective tissue between two women who literally are never going to be able to learn how to speak each other's language, which is Emily and Lorelai. Rory, because she can speak both languages, is sort of, she's the UN. She's the interpreter.
No, she's Switzerland.
Yeah, between the two of them. And that sort of interplay and people, passion and choices in life come with wonderful things and come with consequences. And that's what Midge learns every day when she wakes up in Maisel, is this passion that she discovered in herself, which, by the way, was not even her choice to even find this passion. It just sort of thrust upon her. But because she's decided to act on it in such a decisive way, every day that she wakes up is going to be an adventure, could hold wonderful surprises, and is also could mean terrible things. You know, the touring on the road with Shipe Alban was a blast and fun and romantic, and it was hot and she bought outfits and she learned her voice on stage. And at the same time, she's away from her kids. Her parents are falling apart. You know, her husband's moving on with his life without her. It's like the world, one world is leaving her while it goes in another direction. And those are the consequences that come with passion. And I think because our characters, because we don't tend to do things that are about like a terrorist takes over, you know, Macy's and, you know, we got to get the hostages out, because we are not necessarily plot driven as much as other shows. We are much more character driven. I think you have to delve into the passions of these people to keep it interesting.
No, we're talking passions with the creative force behind The Marvelous Maisel from Amazon, Amy Sherman Palladino and Daniel Palladino. And I guess as we're talking about this too, you say that this is not plotted in any ways, but I feel like what you guys are doing are really treating these things and somebody's life happening in real time. And the passions basically take the place of really, again, traditional narrative, because we're talking about people who lead with their hearts almost all the time. That sort of gives people a different kind of rooting interest, doesn't it? We're following the character rather than trying to see, you know, who's going to cut the blue wire, if you pardon me for bringing up a terrible metaphor here.
Yeah, you know, there's something in Midge's character that is something that the character cannot help. Like what you said about the wedding toast, she knew what she was doing at the end. She knew she was going to drive the crowd crazy, and she didn't care, and we showed that her husband didn't care either, which kind of showed them bonding. And then later in that season, she went up on stage and she had kind of a loneliness of the long distance runner moment of all she had to do was deliver this 10-minute set in front of Sophie Lennon, who is Jane Lynch's character, in front of Sophie Lennon's manager. And basically she was going to score a gig that kind of put her up on a higher level. And because of her dislike of the pomposity of the woman, the whole lifestyle and the hypocrisy of the woman, she just could not help but simply destroy it. And she did it of her own hand, and she did it willfully. So there's definitely something subversive. And I think we like plot that comes. So that to me is like a plot coming out of character, and it's the way we like to do it, as opposed to there's a giant rainstorm and they're locked into the gaslight and they can't get out. Every writer does that too, because that's real too. I mean, there's blackouts, and sometimes people do get stuck on an elevator.
And I have a feeling in the COVID world, there's going to be a lot of scenes of two people stuck in an elevator.
Yes. two people who were just tested and have been quarantining and are now talking to each other in an elevator.
Or a special one, or where one person's just trying to get on a Zoom call.
Mm-hmm. Or there's that. There's a lot of tension and suspense in that.
That's rough.
I mean, I think, though, for me, these shows work because you're writing characters and the actors respond and really take the bit in their teeth and go with it. But I also think it feels like the way you guys write that the characters end up informing where the shows are going to go more than you're laying out conventional sort of plot by.
Yeah, I mean, we've always been stingy with plot, and we've gotten hit for it and we've gotten applauded for it. So, you know, anything is valid. But when my very first writing job was on the original Roseanne, back before conspiracy theory Roseanne, but back when she was delightfully nutty in a different way. The writer's room there, the motto was always make the small big, make the big small. And that was how we did stories on Roseanne. And maybe it's because that's how I was trained, and that was my first gig. And Bob Meyer, who was running the show at the time, was a great showrunner, and I learned so much from him about storytelling. It's always the way I've thought about it. And to do something like that, where you're making the small pieces of life the big thing in a story, it's going to automatically become more about character and what the character is going through and how the character responds to a certain thing that everyone would respond differently to. And we always found ourselves, if we were talking too much about the actual plot of something, knowing we were on the wrong path, because it wasn't about that. The character and the thing that hooked them emotionally, that's what's going to lead you down the path, and that's what you have to follow.
Yeah, we really like doing things like this year in the first show we did in Miami. In the writer's room, we were really happy about the whole Lenny, Bruce, Midge sequence, which had very, very little or almost no plot. But we wanted the challenge of sustaining basically the audience's interest over a long night of...
One of those magic nights.
Yeah, just sort of like a long night of experiences without anything really, really hard in the way of plot happening until the very, very end, which kind of culminated in a sort of will they, won't they thing that I think you kind of felt we were leading up to. But basically, we just wanted to do Miami After Dark. We wanted to show a really, really busy night, and we didn't want to worry about plot. And we really liked how it turned out. And from fan reaction, it seems like they really, really liked it. And I don't think they realized that nothing was really going on. We were really just kind of showing you this kind of fantastic version of an all-night out in Miami.
And playing into that feeling of, you know, a lot of the things we do is playing to a feeling of something. And playing into that feeling of you're out of town, you're someplace new, you know, you're having one of those great hair days where your hair works perfectly and the outfit you picked out works beautifully. And events just happen and unfold in such a way. Maybe you get one of those in a lifetime, but sometimes you get a few of those sort of nights or days where you just don't know what's coming around the bend, and it doesn't matter because your real life has been left so far behind. And that's what that was all about, that particular episode. It landed in some true emotion, but a lot of the things that we do, you know, we did it on Gilmore too, is like when we would do things like the you jump, I jump, Jack, you know, the idea of like what is it when Rory gets swept up into this world of this college group that is, they're the life and death brigade and they're secret, but they have money and they do these insane things that there's no reason. Like what is her, somebody getting swept up in a moment like that? I mean, we enjoy doing that a lot. I mean, frankly, the last episode of Bunheads, since we sort of saw the writing on the wall, even though they hadn't said it was the last episode, I very strongly, as somebody who used to dance, I said, I want to take somebody through what a cattle call of a dancer is like. What is the feeling of from the minute you pick that outfit, get your hair and makeup done, and you hit that and you pin that number on you, and the soul crushing day that you go through to find out that the job you're up for was taken before you showed up there. This was just a union sort of exercise that they put you through. And most of the times that you went on these calls, it was a very similar experience. It was a story about an experience. And I personally, it's one of my favorite episodes that we did on Bunheads because it was just that. I did it piece by piece the way it happened.
And we got to see Sutton Foster fail to get a role, which is extremely rare.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's ever happened.
Yeah, so we got to put her through it.
So you got to show her something she didn't know before.
Yeah, yeah. She got to learn a little. She's like, oh, this is what other people go through on Broadway. This is terrible.
She would deny that. She would deny that. But
well, that's why she's the actress she is. But what I thought was great about that moment, too, is it's also about the utter dehumanization of having your passion taken out of your hands, which is, again, for me, these shows are so much about passion. That was the heartbreak in that. This is thing that, you know, she lived for, and to see that it becomes an existential crisis, which for me, I was wondering if that next season was going to be about how she would define herself again. But anyway, we should take a break. We're talking passion with the creative forces behind The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon. Of course, I'm talking to Amy Sherman Palladino and Daniel Palladino. It's a treatment. We're going to take a break. Clearly, we're talking a lot and have a lot more to talk about. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. We're talking passion and hair with my guests, the creative forces behind The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Amy Sherman Palladino and Daniel Palladino. I guess one of the things I'm really fascinated by in the way you guys work, but especially on Mrs. Maisel, is the way bass line and music plays such a big part in the show. I mean, I'm thinking about, we're always aware of how the pump of the bass lines, even thinking about when those guys are doing the folk song in the club, we hear the acoustic bass going in the pilot. In fact, I think that any show you guys do could have Girl in Trouble by Romeo Void in it.
You know, a lot of times when we pick music, it's sort of like when you're writing jokes and stuff, like if something comes to you immediately or quickly, that's the best way of having something. It's when you have to hunt for it that you end up with something that's not quite what you wanted, but it's close enough. And we were doing that episode in the first, I think it was the first season. And when I was just in the editing room, and just when we, the first time I saw a cut together version of that stand up, I hope I'm remembering these episodes correctly, but first time I saw it, that song just popped out at me, and I said, let's see what that feels like. And we put it in, and it was right. So those are the best times for us for music. And yeah, we do, you know, a lot of it has to do with our sound design too. We have a great sound team that when we mix music, we really want it to sound full. We're always trying to get music to sound fuller. And bass lines just add rhythm to our writing, which is rhythmic in its own sense. So it just kind of feels, it always feels right with drums and bass accompanying our music.
Music has always been important to us. And the thing about Gilmore was done at a time when music was less expensive. Like you can put a lot of music in Gilmore and you could pay for it. And it's a lot more expensive now than it used to be back in the days of the WB when there was a dancing frog as our mascot. But we both have musical backgrounds. I was a dancer until I discovered sandwiches, which ends every dancer's career. And Dan came from a musician side. And I think because of that, and the way we hear comedy in a rhythmic manner, it feels musical to us. You know, to me, when I, you know, I grew up on 2000-Year-Old Man was sort of like the big thing for me as a kid. It was Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner. And there's rhythm to that sort of comedy. There's a definite, like there's a metronome, there's a beat to it. And that is our comedy stylings. Our comedy stylings have sort of an intrinsic, just sort of a dance step to it. And the more that we, you know, then we, obviously when we did Bunheads, which was simply based in a ballet studio, you know, the whole thing is music and an expression through music. And then Maisel just became, because I think a lot of it is because Mitch herself is a character who never stops moving, both in her life and in her emotion and in her physicality. Like she's a character that is constantly propelling herself forward. Her forward motion is everything about, she's a shark. If she stops moving, she dies. And that's portrayed a lot in just the way she walks down the street. And it cries out for music. And we, the more we, you know, when I wrote the pilot of Maisel, there were many musical pieces that were written into it. Wonderful Day Like Today was written into the script. And for many reasons, you know, when you write a pilot script, again, you're showing people the taste and the style of the show. I wanted people to understand the kind of music that I wanted to use.
And then it enabled us when we were shooting, like in the beginning, when she was walking to on her daily errands to Wonderful Day Like Today, we blasted that song wherever we were. So if we were at Riverside Park, we played that song. When we were at the butcher shop, we played that song. So that Rachel and anyone else, and even the background character actors who were so great, knew sort of the rhythm of what we were going for.
It's also important for camera, because if you're shooting something in a certain way and you don't have the musical, now we don't always have every piece in mind, obviously, but for big important camera moves. Yes. Thank you. The word move. We sort of feel it's important, because otherwise what's going to happen is the camera is going to move at its own rhythm, and you can put any piece of music you want in there, you know, but if the camera and the music are not aligned, it's not going to totally feel like one cohesive piece, like everybody was moving together in motion. And so whenever we can, Jim McConkie, who is our Steadicam magician, you know, he will just, if there's a piece of music that is the piece of music we're using, he'll just have them play it, sound play it into his headphones. So he's hearing the music as he's moving the camera. So he understands the feel. Is he floating? Is he marching? Is he pushing forward? Is he letting it drift? I mean, that's all dictated by the music. And there's nothing more frustrating than you have this beautiful camera move, but you want to like goose it up a little bit and you put a piece of music under it. And the music is saying one thing and the camera is saying something else. Like they need to be aligned.
We're talking Count with the creators and the creative forces behind the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Amy Sherman-Palladino, Dan Palladino. As we're talking about this too, I was just thinking about even the more period pieces, like you were saying, It's a Good Day or Pass Me By, we can still feel the bass count in those. And then to go from that to ending with Girls Talk, yeah. You know, which is, again, you can almost hear the count, the 1, 2, 3, or the 5, 4, or whatever it is they're doing. And I think that really applies to almost every piece that's played over the end credits. I mean, going, you know, Our Lips Are Sealed or you know, Curtains, which is the way you ironically finish off the first season, yes. Or going from Open the Door, Richard, to another piece of pop. I mean, and I don't think anybody else has ever used transition of amp on TV before, so thank you guys for that. But I do feel like the bass line in the way that it hadn't been as important in the other shows really is, it's almost like a heartbeat in this show.
Definitely. And one of the great things about Girl Talk is that it was written by Elvis Costello, and he saw it and he sent us a very nice fan note.
So yeah, that was like, kind of the best part of the whole thing.
Yeah, we get to have moments like that because I think the music community knows that we're like, you know, we've been using music like different kinds of music. You know, we had Sparks on Gilmore Girls. We had Sonic Youth on Gilmore Girls. You know, so we shamelessly like just proselytize our own musical taste to people. Amy picked Girl Talk at the end of the pilot because, and I think the way she just thought that would be a cool way to end it. It's got great energy. And I think,
and thematically, it's exactly,
yeah, thematically it works. Doing. And I think it points forward because Midge is a forward pointing character. We know, I don't think it's a big mystery to say that she's got big adventures coming up in her life, and her heyday is going to be kind of the 60s, 70s, 80s.
90s, so like, 100s.
Yeah. So like that music just kind of, that music sort of speaks to her future as well. Lots of appearances on the Mike Douglas Show and
so
stuff
many
like
appearances.
That.
That's where she meets Thin Lizzy and David Bowie, I guess, is on the Mike Douglas Show.
Yeah, yes. There you go. Mm-hmm. All smoking cigarettes, too.
Well, see, but the thing I was going to say is about Maisel as compared to Gilmore Girls and Bunhead is that the choices are much poppier than on those shows. I mean, and I feel like that's, too, about the 60s. In the 70s a little bit, about and the break in pop from the 50s to the 60s, I mean, it becomes an interesting way to sort of tell us who these characters are by having them listen to different kinds of pop and then using pop at the end that's not of the era often to comment on it.
Yeah, and we're trying to keep within a certain clock, you know, time frame. We haven't gone into like any sort of modern music even at the end. We keep it because we want it to be in the future, but not so far in the future that it's completely disconnected. In a weird way, it's not disconnected. It's just sort of the next evolution.
Absolutely. But also even it's almost music that, in terms of the simplicity of a lot of it, could be really inspired by the era from which you're talking about. Again, for me, that segue in the episode that goes from that beautiful a cappella Open the Door, Richard, to then Sly and the Family Stone, is just, it really kind of shows a kind of lineage in the way pop, one piece of pop leads to another.
Yeah, it's a lot of times it's a happy accident. We knew that they were going to sing Open the Door, Richard, at the end of that. I have a iPhone list of music for Maisel that is now forever long. It's long, 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 long. of just songs that we like. Like, we'll remember something, we'll say, oh, put that on. So like at some point, 10cc One Night in Paris was on that, you know, like, just different odd things, some really well-known, some not. That's a little more of an obscure Sly and the Family Stone song, but I've always loved it. Like, there are certain songs, you know, we tend towards a certain kind of pop song, whether it's a song in the 40s or a song written last year. We like a drive and a melody. A lot of times we like the whimsy of it.
Whimsy.
And yeah, and it just felt right to go from Open the Door, Richard, to Sly and the Family Stone. music is often like you find a happy link. We have millions of songs in our heads and we have millions of CDs and LPs in our basement and up in all corners of our house here. But the best thing is like, if you think that we constructed this amazing thing, it might just have been an accident because we have so many songs in our head.
Yes, we did.
Or we're just great.
Just make us look smart for once.
But you know, accidents come about because you are constantly exploring and you are constantly trying something. So
we're talking about a kind of a spiritual synchronicity here. Let me ask you about this one, because so we're talking about a tag that goes into a song to have the end of an episode with Susie saying "We're the whitest people in the world" to the Paul Williams version of
I mean,
there is no whiter version of that song, and it was originally done by the Carpenters. So
whiter than the Carpenters version, which is
exactly that. So I mean, I thought that was actually, and have that and the Open the Door, Richard, in the same season was pretty amazing to me.
I'm mad about Paul Williams. The other day I watched Bugsy Malone the other day.
Because Alan Parker?
When Alan Parker died, I went down an Alan Parker wormhole because a lot of his movies meant Bugsy Malone was huge. Fame, obviously huge. Sure. You know, the Commitments. I mean, that guy really knew how to use music. Like he had a love of music and he really knew how to show struggle and stuff through music that I don't know. I had a whole Alan Parker moment that people are like still going, you got to get over it. You've never even met Alan Parker. But it's like, so I went down a Bugsy Malone, Paul Williams wormhole last week.
Well, I just had Oliver Stone on. You don't want to read his books. You don't want to be disillusioned about Alan Parker. But I will ask you this, because we're talking about music. And one of the things that was really interesting to me, the last episode, and we just had Wanda Sykes on, but she's doing a terrific job as Moms Mabley. And the way she uses silence, which, when there's silence in your shows, it really lands really hard too. And we can feel so much, we're talking subtext and judgment, all those things happening when Moms is just looking at Midge as Midge is just going on and Moms isn't saying anything. And she gets a long beat of silence after Midge finishes talking.
In defense of our rapid pace writing, which again, some people love, some people like to kick us in the head for it. We often feel like life happens at a faster pace than people realize and then is often dramatized. And when you're setting up for those dramatic moments, if there's been life and energy and chatter and motion and movement, when everything stops, when it's earned, I just think it's that much more effective, as opposed to a show where everything is sort of paced exactly the same. And you may even like miss the real emotional moment because it's the same feel as the moment that just happened right before them when they ordered a cup of coffee. So it just, our comedy, but when we go for our emotional moments, we want them to really land. And if we're going to have people stop, if there's going to be silence, it needs to be completely earned. And what's interesting about Wanda is I knew Wanda as this just really, really funny stand-up. And just, and often when she was doing movies, she was kind of the wise ass side person who was the truth teller, you know, often a lot of times, but just sort of the funny, just there to be, just be really sharp and acidic and funny. And what I found so interesting is you can put a camera on Wanda and there's just like a million things going on in that head of hers. And it's all on the face. And that little scene that they do afterwards, it was so effective and it was so important because we were, you know, we were not only dramatizing someone real, which we don't do a lot because a lot of responsibility comes along with that, but we were dramatizing a pioneer of not just Black female comics, but female comics, period. So there was a lot of respect, you know, attention must be paid. And that scene had to have a lot going on there. And I keep saying it to her. And I think one of these days she's just going to like slug me and say, stop saying this to me. But I was just so amazed and taken aback by the fact that I could just infinitely stare at her face during those moments. And she was taking it all in and she was processing it all and trying to figure out who this little girl in pink in front of her was and what she was doing there. And then when she found it out, the look on her face just to me was almost a little heartbreaking. It was like, this is what my life is. You know, this is the insults that get paid to me. I deserve better than this, but I'm gracious and I'm smart enough to know this isn't going to be an easy task for her. I mean, there was just like a lot of stuff happening there. And she just really nailed that boy.
She did. We're out of time. We're way out of time. I can't thank you guys enough for doing it. My guests, who have been incredibly gracious with their time, are the creative forces behind The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon, Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino. Guys, thank you so much for doing this.
Elvis. Thank you. Thanks for doing our other panels for
us. We so appreciate it. You have no idea.
Recording engineer at KCRW is Desmond Taylor. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.